On the evening of February 11th, 2019, the historic Ellen Theater was filled with Bose maniacs who had gathered to celebrate the release of the book, Bozeman from the Heart.
Welcome to Bozeman from the Heart, a Valentine for this town. You are all in for a real treat tonight of homegrown talent. My name is Paula Beswick. Along with June Safford, Stephanie Newman, and 25 gifted local writers, we bring you our stories from the heart. From the moment that June invited me to share her vision of creating this book, I gladly agreed to go along for the ride. I must also thank a couple of groups for helping us to make this all happen, starting with the Gilhausen Family Foundation and the Montana Arts Council, who believed in our little project right from the beginning and provided some necessary funds to help us get going. Along with them, the Bozeman Public Library Foundation. And if we make any money when all of this is over, all proceeds will be going to the Library Foundation because they do so much to help our beloved library. In addition to these groups, we are indebted to our businesses and personal sponsors who kept the flame alive for the 2 years while we worked on the book. You'll find all 34, yes, 34 names listed in the back of the book. Please continue to support downtown businesses who give back to our community every day. And now I get to introduce you to the editor and instigator of this book, my friend June Billings Safford. Many of you know June as a Bozeman High School teacher, English teacher, and believe me, she remembers a lot of you as teenagers. She tells me stories. She is also a published poet and an accomplished painter. If you haven't seen her work yet, you will relish over the images of Main Street throughout the pages of the book. Since working with her these past couple of years, my respect and admiration has grown. Not only has she worked tirelessly on the book, but she cross-country skis, she swims, she does yoga, travels, keeps up with family and friends, and she also reads voraciously, telling me about books that I'm reading and sharing books that she's reading. So when I grow up, I want to be June.
Yeah. And Paula, I hope you never grow up. So welcome to an event that is more about a town than a book. If this theater were a tent, why, we could say this is a revival. It turns out I edited a love story. All of us, the staff and 25 talented local and nationally known writers who joined to bring the book about, we all hope that all reading this book will find themselves deep into their own reminiscences, like the magician's handkerchief. May each piece you read pull out for you rich memories of your own. To learn about how this book came about, I suggest you read the introduction and learn why I am grateful to friends like Leslie Bredvick and Diana Tremaine and Susan Blackwood. However, two people I've never met and never mentioned before played a part in the genesis. I'm speaking about Eric Dietrich and Gail Schanzler, journalists who in 2016 wrote in the Chronicle a series of articles about unbridled growth in Bozeman in the Gallatin Valley. These were articles which set me thinking about the need to first discover who we are before despairing about our future. On the screen, you see what I call my rehearsal painting. I painted this from the third floor apartment in Brooklyn, and I was just 16 years old. What I always take away from this painting is how my earliest experience with paint, color took precedence. It still does. Now, approaching those twilight years, I return to painting buildings, initiating the series a year after the terrible explosion in 2009 that took these marvelous three buildings, Montana Trails Gallery, the IOOF building, the American Legion, and sadly, Tara Ristead Bowman. Yeah, it was in response to this loss that I judged it was important to render Bozeman downtown. And at that time, I never imagined I would eventually complete 50 paintings, and I never thought in terms of a book until that fateful conversation with Susan Blackwood. I'm not known as being haughty, but I'm here tonight to tell you I was brilliant. When I came to choose Paula Beswick as my co-editor, besides being an idea woman, she's vivacious, and that's why she's the MC. Also, her journalistic experience was a perfect fit for this publication. My second stroke of genius was when I discovered Stephanie Newman, now retired, former graphic design professor at MSU. Stephanie doesn't get the recognition she rightly deserves, so I asked her to come on stage and take a bow, and she declined. Very typical of Stephanie. She put that beautiful book together right in a corner of her kitchen. She crafted a beautiful book for a wonderful town. I want to thank all who went on this journey with me, and I certainly want to thank everyone here tonight for making this trip to the wonderful, wonderful Ellen Theater. Thank you so much.
All the bird songs of Montana take the air with the sound of the wind, the sound of the streams, even the sky. They're all embedded. Montana is music. It's all music. Music connects with everything. Montana is home. Bozeman is home within my home. Beautifully written by Eric Funk on page 57. Next up to talk about his home is Steve Kirchhoff. Steve has also taught at high school and at the college level for nearly 30 years, the last 21 at MSU in the Honors College and Political Science and English departments. If you haven't sat in a classroom for a while, you may remember him as a Bozeman City Commissioner from 99 to 2007, two of those years serving as mayor. And what I think you'll find a common theme with our writers, Steve also extols the pleasures of a good book.
Welcome one and all to a celebration of Bozeman. My name is Steve. I'm from Bozeman. I was born in Bozeman. Bozeman is my hometown. Bozeman is a place that we all love. I mean, collectively, right? That's why we're all here tonight. And welcome to a celebration of our collectivity, all of us together. I think the two of those things are nearly the same thing. Thanks especially to June Safford. She was a teacher of mine in high school. Joanne Troxell, who is also an author whose words are included in this great book, was a teacher of mine. If Michael Durney is in the house, he's not. That would be amazing, because those are the three guiding lights of my life. Three English teachers from Bozeman Senior High School when I was a kid. Anyway, thank you, and thanks especially to June for the idea that launched into this beautiful book with all the beautiful feelings about our beautiful town. You are beautiful, June. Thanks especially to Paula Beswick for sharing the vision and the labor of love that were required to make the book into a reality, and to John Luden, the maestro here, for his tireless efforts to preserve Bozeman through the arts and through gatherings for the arts, which is, I guess, another way of saying to save the soul of our town. And a big thanks to all the authors. They put their words down on paper to make this book such a rich and lovely experience to read. I like the word town. I mean, it speaks to what is near and accessible. We relate personally to a town. It's manageable. In a town, our regard grows for what is near, and what is near also seems to enter into us. It's a kind of merging. I like the town of Bozeman because it is a place where a person can be left alone, or it can merge with someone else without having to use the internet. A lot of people come to Bozeman as if they are coming home to themselves. I also like Bozeman because of time. In a lot of places, people relate to time as if it were a commodity exchanged on a market. Time is money, they say. Horse feathers. The notion that there was a price on time in Bozeman when I was young, and until very recently, it used to be a joke. I mean, a price on time. What a joke. It's still a joke, but now hardly anybody laughs at it. Now people monetize their time and they try to monetize ours, yet time's true purchase is in our soul. When that sort of time goes, I'm afraid that some of the merging with the place also goes. Here in Bozeman, I have felt the opportunity to work on the basic problems of what I hope is a civilized human life, such as, where does the spirit come from? Am I eternal beyond this flesh? What do I do for my neighbor? Can I be happy when others are suffering? What do I teach my children? How can we live artfully and beautifully? Bozeman, I think, has given us time to discover our way of answering these and other questions. Bozeman has at least given me this gift, which is not to say that I have not squandered it. But this place, I mean this landscape, and the feelings that it imparts have given me a lot. And when it comes right down to it, the land is first. The land is first, but we are not second. Not at all. The land is first, and oxygen is second. And third is not us either. Third is water. And then fourth, you're thinking, okay, we come in, it ain't. No, fourth is the plants. Imagine trying to live here or anywhere else without plants. Thank you, plants. Thank you, plants, for putting up with us so far. Maybe finally in the fifth position, considering priority, living off the benefits of the first four, we, the humans, come in. We're some sort of a mutation of the land, totally dependent, needing help and assistance, needing love that is freely given by the land and oxygen and water and plants. These things help us to remember who we are. Anyway, I am grateful to have come from such a beneficent corner of the world with just this town in it. Thank you, Bozeman. Thank you, people of Bozeman. And thank you, June Safford, for this book.
We are living in a time defined not just by the changes we see around us, but changes on a global scale. All of this serves to make Bozeman's Main Street increasingly important to the character of our community. Stephen Jackson, page 44. Christy Smith is many things. Trustee of the Belgrade Community Library, Director Gail Bacon is here tonight, another wonderful community library. She's an author, speaker for the Humanities Montana Speaker Bureau, self-proclaimed verbivore, and noted voice of KGLT's radio production, Christy the Word Smith, heard across NPR radio waves. Born and raised in Poplar, along Montana's celebrated High Line, Christy knows a thing or two about the importance of community.
My original aspiration for my life before I ever dreamed of a career in radio and dictionaries and a combination thereof was to be an archaeologist. And so in the fall of 1988, I enrolled in MSU to achieve that goal. And I was such an ardent and passionate student that I got my undergrad degree in 7 short years. But I was an alarmingly serious student until a quiet incident and a small surprise on Bozeman's Main Street changed my world forever. Call it the Terrafocal Shuffle. It's the amble assumed by the survey archaeologist, head bent, eyes sweeping the ground in a 90-degree arc to the front and sides of the body, spraddled legs stumping slowly and gracelessly across the landscape. In the early 1990s, I spent 2 summers perfecting the Terrafocal Shuffle. I was a part of a cohort of Montana State University archaeology work study students investigating a 9,500-year-old food processing site in southwestern Montana. By day, we carefully scraped layer from layer the soil that held clues to prehistoric human lifeways, charcoal hearths containing processed animal bone, and evidence of cooked plants and cracked seeds. After dinner, we perfected the terrafocal shuffle. In the long evening hours, we took to the nearby creek beds and hillsides in search of surface artifacts. We had trained our eyes to detect the disciplined shape of a stone projectile point lying in a wash. We knew how to find teepee rings, 9-foot circles of skull-sized stones situated on the ridges overlooking our camp. Eventually, we learned to recognize what the profession calls lithic debitage, small chips of chert and obsidian discarded in the manufacture of stone tools. I and my classmates peered deeply those 2 summers into the dark, seductive glass of prehistory. What we could know of 9,000-year-old people, we found in the ancient soil under our modern feet. We dreamed of bison, of antelope, of cooking fires smoking the valley. We nearly swooned over the notion of touching stone tools fashioned before the invention of time. Deep into the evening, we hungrily sought the debitage scattered across the fragrant landscape. The terrafocal shuffle became a vesper's posture in which we communicated across the ages. By the end of field school, one of my shuffling feet was irretrievably planted in the soil of prehistory. With this asymmetrical gait, I reluctantly returned to fall college classes, a town life, and a windowless job. The terrafocal shuffle seemed maladaptive on campus and city sidewalks, too slow, too wide, too unattractive. Walking to campus or my Main Street job in the days after my return, I defaulted to the shuffle. Pah, ridiculous. The uniformity of the city footscape starved my eyes. My cohorts and I slowly rejoined the rhythm of town life. Feral all summer long, we had to relearn classroom manners. In our formal archaeology curriculum that fall, we politely studied the prehistoric tools, art, and burial practices of other people on other continents. At my job, in a shop on Bozeman's Main Street, I reacquainted myself with the minutiae of picture framing, a skill I had acquired in my early 20s before taking up college classes in archaeology. I folded up the summer field clothes and resurrected the retail outfits. With no time to waste in my town life, I strode up and down Main Street on errands, to and from lunch, and back and forth to home and school. I deleted the terrafocal shuffle from my body's vocabulary. Until early one fall morning, I walked to work from my apartment on Curtis Street. Long, low shadows stretched from buildings, signposts, bicycles chained to racks. Darkened sidewalk cracks appeared to drop into oblivion. Even random pebbles scattered across the way cast remarkable shadows. Mesmerized by the play of light below, I felt my stride slacken, my feet span in wider measure. My eyes swept the sidewalk in the familiar arc, eating the details. Approaching the old Gallatin State Bank building on the corner of Main and Tracy Streets, I stopped, arrested by an irregular shape on the aging sidewalk. The low sun revealed, in relief, a pair of diminutive handprints embossed on the concrete. A small, smooth, oval stone sat neatly where one of the palms would have pressed. The length of my finger nearly spanned the width of the 2 handprints. The child who bore her delicate weight in the concrete must have been no more than 3 years old. I finished my archaeology studies. I did not pursue the profession, but I still embrace its tenets and fascinations. With that peculiar gait, I catch evidence of past lives almost everywhere I hike, in the coulees, the stone circles on the ridges, an ancient bison trail arcing over a hill. But the handprints on Bozeman's Main Street sidewalk taught me that the terrafocal shuffle can reveal all manner of treasures from the past. Elsewhere in town, I've seen evidence of dog, magpie, and young person in KEDS walking across uncured sidewalk concrete. The delicate vascular impressions of fallen leaves litter the walkways. The groove of old-style bicycle tires snake brazenly across the squares. I laughed out loud once at the amble of calf hoof prints embossed in a sidewalk of Helena's historic district, imagining the growing city's intrusion upon pastures. I often think, with gratitude, of the Bozeman child who left a whisper of her existence in the fresh concrete decades ago.
Whether we call Greater Bozeman / Gallatin Valley our home or are smitten when visiting, we feel blessed by a deep connection of mutual civic passion, bolstered by the abiding sweep of natural landscape around us. Thank you to noted author Todd Wilkinson for the kind words found in his foreword to the book. Bozeman is blessed with many talented people, musicians, artists, authors, as well as poets. Next, we have two of them who contributed to Bozeman from the Heart. First out will be Greg Keeler, former MSU English professor. He is a noted poet and singer-songwriter. He has published books of poetry, has had 6 plays produced 10 tapes and CDs of his satirical songs, and published many articles in popular and academic magazines and journals. As with Eric Funk, Greg received the Montana Governor's Award in Humanities. Here tonight, Greg will read a short sonnet. Carolyn Panay was born in South Wales, but taught Spanish language and literature, Latin American literature and history for 30 years at MSU. Her poetry has appeared in many publications and earned her great accolades.
This poem's called Bozeman Creek, but a lot of people call it sourdough. I call it whatever my mood is, I'll call it that. I'll call it Bozeman Creek today. This is Bozeman in the late 70s, so some of the things that are on Bozeman Creek then aren't there now, but some still are. So Bozeman Creek. It starts up in the highlights where elk dab their tongues and runs quick on rocks down through farms sparse then thick to developments, then town. All of this in 10 miles packs history to an instant lesson where the pupils are awed by the teacher's knowledge but never learn. The fast water moves to the undercut meadows to parks, then beneath pavement, buildings, old houses, railroad tracks, then out to join the slower streams and rivers rip-wrapped with broken concrete and old cars. In town, the law leaves fishing to the children, so they learn best. One might drift a worm under the tire store, the Eagle's Bar, the bank parking lot, the old hotel, and catch brook trout, pale, thin memories of cutthroats that lie upstream, or prophecies of survival in rough German browns that burrow downstream in the carcasses of rusted-out cars. One spring, the stream took a girl fresh from drink at the Eagles and pulled her under downtown Bozeman in the range of those dim brook trout. It is spring again, and the water comes cold, hard, and fast from where the elk dips to where these ghosts hold firm in the current under the old hotel. And here's Carolyn.
Hello, everybody. I'm sure that you all can't tell by my accent that I'm not originally from here. Well, I may not be originally from here, but I feel as though perhaps I am originally from here in some other strange and magical way. About 2 years ago, in the springtime, I marched with many fellow Bozemanites for the future health of the planet, all along Main Street and into Linley Park. All that time, I was thinking of Mimi and of all our children across the globe. And later, I wrote this poem, Marching for Mimi. You would say, by the way, but Grandma, I'm 7 now and I'm in second grade. So you have to think 2 years ago, just about think back a little bit. Marching for Mimi, spring 2017. Suddenly, a bright day in Bozeman, it brings us out in swarms like the honeybees we want to see survive. Women, men, kids, dogs carry signs, chant with humor, with hope. When you wave to the donkeys in the field, pick a purple crocus, collect shiny rocks from the stream, I omit to tell you how fragile all this is. You draw flowers, trees, stars, sun in a perfect sky. They scintillate on the white page. The woman marching by my side tells me the rich have already booked their flights to another planet. I march for this one, and for you, almost 6, planting the seeds in which you place your trust. this bravely flowering spring. Thank you.
Few places embody Bozeman's identity and adaptive spirit, as well as Main Street. Originally, the infamous Bozeman Trail, this historic corridor has been the essence of the community since the town's founding in 1864. That's from our historian, Derek Strawn, on page 11. Valerie Hemingway is a native of Dublin, Ireland, but has called Bozeman home since 1980. Author of the 2004 memoir, Running with the Bulls, My Years with the Hemingways, Valerie's work has also been featured in many national magazines, but few know that her first job in Bozeman was at a local, iconic business.
Well, like Carolyn, I'm an import. I don't think we don't really like to use the word alien these days. Lived in New York City for quite a while, but when it was decided we'd come out to Bozeman, I was rather horrified. In fact, I was the reluctant one of six of us. But in fact, that was almost 39 years ago, and here I am today. And my son Edward, everybody else has scattered, but Edward has come back to Bozeman, but he's been gone for about 17 years. And he's here tonight. Country Bookshelf, a local legend. The first job I held in Bozeman was as a part-time salesperson at the Country Bookshelf, Bozeman's independent bookstore, then housed in the Whitechapel on West Main Street. We moved here in 1980 from New York City on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And a year later, I searched for something to do outside our Bridger Canyon home. Since the children were attending school in town, a 25-mile daily round trip to Bozeman was on the agenda to accommodate their extracurricular activities. I had, by that time, consumed large quantities of coffee at the Leaf and Bean, Bozeman's only coffee shop, and exhausted other idling outlets, with the exception of shopping that had very little interest for me unless the purchase was glued between covers. When a part-time job seemed a suitable solution, I stopped in at the Work Service Center. I quickly learned that I failed the first two questions. Are you an American citizen? No. Do you have a college degree? No. After 20 years of living in the United States and working in an executive capacity in New York City in the newspaper and publishing world, I discovered I was unemployable. Unless, of course, I wanted to enter the fast food trade. Perhaps even don a Golden Arches uniform. What a relief it was then, and indeed a restoration of self-esteem, to get that telephone call from the Country Bookshelf and learn that I was hired for 10 hours weekly at $3.25 an hour, the prevailing minimum wage. Since I happily spent all my earnings on books, which the staff could purchase at a generous discount, my take-home salary almost doubled and provided plenty of reading material for my leisure moments. Country Bookshelf has had a distinguished history since its inception in 1957, when Bozeman native Polly Rennie opened the original shop downtown on Tracy, close to Main Street. Polly enjoyed running a bookshop, but found it economically challenging. When she decided to cut her losses, another Bozeman native, Marguerite Kirk, purchased the business and in a short time moved the bookstore to the Whitechapel. Marguerite soon rented the space to the young Mary Jane McGinley, whose ingenuity, savvy, and sheer knowledge and love of books shaped Country Bookshelf over a quarter of a century to become the legend it is today. The Whitechapel was tucked behind the Red Barn, a quaint pairing in a semi-rustic setting, close then to the outskirts of town, now solidly central. It had been the first Roman Catholic church in Bozeman, precursor to Holy Rosary Church, now at Main and Third. It amuses me to think that Marguerite Kirk, whose surname means church, rescued the church from demolition. She retained the ownership of the building during her lifetime, but the bookshop would change hands twice and its location once between then and the present day. The chapel was the perfect setting for a bookstore, with its Gothic shape and rustic old-world exterior. The vestibule was a small space where customers could shake themselves off in the snowy winter weather before entering the nave. It was used each year to display the calendars on sale in the early spring. Inside, a huge log fire created a warm and cozy atmosphere, thanks to the staff, who took turns feeding it local pine logs. The choir loft provided a private nook where the browser could also enjoy a quiet read without interference. When Mary Jane designed her downtown premises, she carried over this choir loft feature with a wraparound balcony containing sale books, biographies, world affairs, philosophy, travel, hobbies, and books of other categories. She provided comfortable armchairs and good lighting, giving the customer every incentive to stay and nibble between the pages, and with luck, to carry away with them some of the goodies they had tasted. Mary Jane loved plants as well as books. Her green thumb was evident in the many plants that adorned the shop. If watering was needed, the chore was taken care of by whoever was on duty. My favorite plant was the Christmas cactus that belonged to Mary Jane's grandmother. It was large and venerable and not greedy for water. Towards Thanksgiving and again at Christmas time, the tips of the foliage cascaded over the sides and a profusion of pink flowers burst into bloom. 30 years later, the cactus is still there, upstairs on the balcony in the present-day store. Although she left it behind, Mary Jane continues to keep a watchful eye. "I've noticed it needs a little care," she told me recently. "I must tend to it the next time that I'm in the shop." The plants, it turned out, were not the only living things at the Whitechapel. Two memorable events during my tenure involved creatures, not to my knowledge, book-reading ones. Nibblers might be a better fit. I'd been working for some months when my colleague Linda Jones asked me if I could open up for her the next day. She said I was to make sure to arrive before 9 a.m. Many of you probably know about my punctuality problem. It's an Irish fault, I believe. This was a big responsibility and showed that I had passed through the first hoop. I was given the keys and instructed in the morning ritual. With a history of responsible executive jobs in New York City, I did not doubt my ability to perform until I came to one particular item on the agenda: empty mouse traps. This was an unanticipated challenge. At the time, the Red Barn next door contained a saddle shop run by a genial Southerner named Frank Ford, who happened to be a Bridger Canyon neighbor of mine. Our children took the same bus to school each morning, and so we were somewhat acquainted. Tall, every bit the Southern gentleman whose sons answered, "Yes, sir," and "Yes, ma'am," when spoken to, Frank provided the solution to my dilemma. Whenever a mouse carcass needed to be removed, I knocked on the barn door and Frank came to the rescue. I never did get over my squeamishness. I would rather live with live mice than have to detrap dead ones. But books provide fodder for hungry rodents, and that was not an option. I wonder if mice are the reason that many bookshops have a resident cat. I'm thinking in particular of the icon of bookshops, the late Gotham Book Mart in New York City, where one could stroll in and see some of the great writers and intellectuals of the day browsing among the shelves, with always a cat or two to be found stretched out in front of the books, curled in a quiet corner or snoozing on an overstuffed chair. Last time I was there, Salman Rushdie was picking up a book and engaging in some lively literary observation with the store's owner at the front desk. I happily eavesdropped as I waited my turn and felt it came far too soon. One morning, when I was alone minding the shop in the Whitechapel, the phone rang. "Country Bookshelf, can I help you?" was my standard greeting.
"This is the sheriff's office," came an authoritative voice. "Did you know that you have bats in your belfry? Why don't you check the bats in your own belfry?" I snipped and hung up, feeling pretty smug. Pranksters weren't going to fool me. A short while later, the sheriff's car pulled up. "Morning," said the officer with a nod of his head. "Just here to check your belfry. We're told you have a stack of bats there. Best get rid of them." Oh my God, I thought. That call was from the sheriff's office. This is a church. It has a belfry. And what should be in that belfry, if not bells, but bats? How could I have been so dense? "Thank you," I said, as if it were the most normal exchange in the world, and I set about my business unpacking books and calling customers whose special orders had arrived.
In the 1950s and 60s, Bozeman's downtown was a moving, magical novelty for me. Jan Elpel, page 96. Keith McCafferty is the survival and outdoor skills editor of Field and Stream and the author of the Sean Stranahan mystery series published by Viking Penguin Books. His novels, sometimes referred to as fly fishing noir, include The Royal Wolf Murders, The Grey Ghost Murders, and Dead Man's Fancy. Someone else seeing a pattern here? Among several prestigious awards, including Crazy Mountain Kiss winning the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Best Western Contemporary Novel. Two of Keith's books, also two, made Oprah's recommended reading list. Luckily for us, he isn't slowing down and currently working on his eighth novel. I don't know about you, but I think that Bozeman and surrounding lands aren't just settings in his books, they're characters.
Well, thank you. We're all here because we consider Bozeman to be a treasure. And before I say anything, I just wanted to say that Eric and Jenny, you are treasures of this town. When I was in the fourth grade, a teacher asked me to write the three places I'd like to live. And my first choice was India because I loved tigers. And my second was Africa because I loved lions. And my third choice was Montana because I loved the name. And I always had wanted to come fishing out here. My hero was Al McLean, the fishing editor of Field and Stream. And my goal in life was to marry his daughter and take his job. I didn't, but I came close. And now I kill people on the page, which brings me to Murder on Main. And I want to say thank you to, of course, Paula and to June, and to the caffeine providers in this town, some of whom are here tonight, and particularly Wild Joe's Coffee Spot. Erica Brubaker, who owns it, is here tonight, and they have kindly provided the live prop that I need for this story. So without further ado, I will read Murder on Main, which actually is true. These are truth people. Some of names have been changed to protect the guilty. It's 7 in the morning at Wild Joe's Coffee Spot, and I am looking for the next to die. The choices aren't many at this hour. There's Brian sitting in the front window overlooking Main Street, his bird book cracked, turkey feather under his hat band. He walks up, shows me a photograph he took of cranes, first pair of the year. Spring's coming, and it's all too soon for me. I like to have another notch on my belt before the gophers come out of hibernation and start eating their roadkill sisters. Brian's a fixture, so he's in no real danger. You never kill a fixture. It's rule number one. I look around as Molly sashays in, all 6 feet two of her, orders her coffee to go, and she's out the door, and it's like three people have left. Her smile is better than the first sip of coffee, so she's safe as a church, at least from the likes of me. I'm a liar by trade, a murder mystery writer to be precise, a man who plucks his victims from coffee shops and kills them on paper. From Sola Cafe to the south, to Treeline in the north, and Main Street one end to the other, I've left blood on all the pretty floors. I take a long breath in and let it out. I broke ribs falling off my bike onto the ice this winter. One of the joys of living in Bozeman. Just the kind of place for a nice guy like me to raise a family and pass as normal. It only hurts when I breathe. Jim comes in next. He's retired from the Forest Service, a lean, silver-haired cross fox, the Wall Street Journal under his arm. All these coffee shop people, also informed. We nod, we smile. He has no idea he's dead. He was one of the bodies that the search dog found up on Sphinx Mountain in the Grey Ghost murders, the victim of a bullet from a Nitro Express double rifle. Needless to say, he died quickly. I could kill him again, of course, but who wants to repeat himself? I don't. I walk up to the counter and order a cappuccino and works bagel, hold the cream cheese. Or rather, Kayla places the order without prompting. It's nice to be where somebody knows your name. She bumps fist with me, asks,
"What's up?"
same old, I say. Just looking for somebody to kill. And she rolls her eyes and smiles her smile. Kayla's a real positive life force. Smart and sassy with me, the best cheekbones in Bozeman. She brings my cappuccino with a sidecar of fizzy water, even has a little arrangement of coffee beans and chocolate dust placed just so on the board.
"Your Norwegian sweater is to die for,"
she says. An interesting choice of words. She leaves, and I count my lucky stars that are still fading from the sky. I would never kill a barista, not even dream of it. It's rule number two. First order of the day is to shoot Sarah an email, telling her I have commandeered the best table, the one with the little lamp. She emails back, "On my way." I call Sarah my writing partner, but we don't actually write together. We sit on opposite sides of the table, consult, talk of this and that, but not very much. You want company for your work, but it is work. I've written 8 novels in our town's caffeine providers, going all the way back to the days of the Leaf and Bean and Union Hall, a coffee shop before the term was coined. Sarah brings the cold air in with her, slings the strap of her messenger bag on a shoulder of a chair, and flounces down. Says, "I sleep on the cold, hard ground. I don't complain when it rains. I'm not a bitch." A pause, she said. Another pause, said like a bitch. I raise my eyebrows, but she fails to notice. Sarah's got a big hush-hush project underway, writing the history of a very important person. Much more of an organized effort than the simple lies I string together. The only problem Sarah has is that she still thinks writing's fun. The first time I saw her, she was giggling at some deft turn of phrase. I couldn't stand for that and walked right up and told her to stop it, that this was serious work and no fun at all. "Who called you a bitch?" I asked innocently enough. "Nobody," she says. "It's a long story," by which she means it's not one I'm going to hear. I call Sarah and my other writing partners my posse. Sarah has corrected me. She says they are my harem. I choose to ignore that she laughs when she says this. Not only am I old enough to be my writing partner's fathers, I am that most unexciting of all humans, a happily married, slightly graying, okay, slightly more than slightly, monogamous man. I'm just about as harmless as I can be, unless, that is, it's your time to die. We get to work, and when I look up again, Marty has joined Jim at his table. They're old friends, bend toward each other talking. She could turn all the boys' heads back when. Anybody who has eyes can see that. But I seldom kill the people I know. Jim was the exception. I don't know what got into me. Just saw him as a corpse one morning, the bear that dug him up from a shallow grave having enjoyed a snack. Usually they're strangers, these damned and would-be dead. No rhyme or reason. You just look at somebody and see the fish nibbling his toes, or pecked out eye sockets staring from a chimney flue, or a royal wolf trout fly in the lip of a bloated corpse. Surely I'm not the only one this kind of thing happens to. We all see people who need to be dead, and not just politicians. I'm thinking back a few years now, when I was looking to make a kill in homepage, long gone now, and in walked a young man with a beatific smile, who was more beautiful than handsome, his long hair in ringlets, sapphire eyes, questionable hygiene. He was a hippie Jesus at first glance, Charles Manson at the second. I pictured him as the alpha male of a wolf pack from hell, with his mates doing his bloody bidding, could envision taking one of those Svengali eyes out of his socket with a grapefruit spoon. He ended up at the bottom of Cliff Lake. Some troller will reel him in, think he's hooked a new state record. Sadly, real life can intrude into reveries like this, even in coffee shops. I've lost several of my pals over the years. The last time I saw my physical therapist was here at Joe's. He'd been sitting alone, this burly man who always struck me as larger than life. He hugged me, tears on his cheeks. "I'm dying," he said. "They can't even tell me how long I have." I reminded him of how much good he'd done for so many people. You don't know what to say, really. And he walked out onto the sidewalk, and I never saw him again. It raises a question. Just how deep does a shared cup of Java go? The answer is, with few exceptions like Sarah, not far. Coffee shop patrons are like the fishermen you share the river with. You are in the current with them for a while, and then they float downstream through time, around the bend. That is where a river goes, around the bend and out to sea. Listen to a current too long, and what you hear are the notes it is missing. But I digress. Nostalgia, like inspiration, is for amateurs. This morning I am not looking to make a friend. I'm looking to make a kill. And in she walks, this coffee shop temptress as tawny as a lioness, with a ruff of fake fur on her shoulders and her jeans all aglitter, so many encrusted rhinestones as to make Elvis blush. She's just the right age for the page I've been stuck on, too. I know before she turns her head that readers will love her when she's alive and cry for her when she's dead. And it's not really my fault that four fangs will meet in her throat. Or maybe she'll catch a bullet in the heart. I haven't decided. These things must be done delicately, as they say in Oz. She's looking in my direction now. Can she feel the danger? No, she's turning away. And ever so discreetly, I cock my finger and drop the hammer with my thumb. Blow invisible smoke from an imaginary barrel. Dead before her butt bling hits the chair. And that's it. Thank you.
A brilliant rainbow forms over the Bridger Mountains. I feel like that little girl again. Meadowlarks and rainbows don't lie. Deanne Brandon, page 94. John Luden has 35 years of experience as a producer, director, and Emmy-winning writer in TV, film, and entertainment industry. All fabulous, but most importantly for all of us here tonight, in 1995, John co-founded Montana Theater Works. And in 2008, with a lot of community help, he reopened the Ellen Theater. June and I are so grateful to John, Glenda Singer, the entire Ellen staff and volunteers for giving us this beautiful space to celebrate our book and Bozeman. John will be reading and wrapping up the evening for us. Thank you so much for allowing us into your hearts.
Thank you, June, for inviting me to contribute to this book. I wrote something on behalf of the theater. It is called If These Walls Could Talk, and I just realized that 16-point font is not large enough. Well, I remember when I was a kid, I heard Bing Crosby say reading was like playing the trombone. I didn't get what he meant, and then now I get it. I have these. If These Walls Could Talk. A million happy faces, that's the first thing that comes to mind. So many happy faces. I know, a million. You think it sounds like a cliche at best, and more than likely an exaggeration. Well, if we're going to have this conversation, you're also sure to ask, how does one trust the word of a wall? Let's start by disputing that old adage about being dumb as a brick. You put together enough bricks and a wall is extremely reliable, right on the beam, or in my case, underneath it. There will be places to groan. Well, that was a joke. The fact is, us walls have been supporting the Ellen for the past several decades. Since 1919, to be exact. Sure, we've been papered over and painted more than a few times, but rest assured that all is plumb on the level. Now you get it. Each year since Ellen's doors first opened, tens of thousands of patrons have been in attendance. Unless my plaster is completely cracked, a million is easily well under the actual number of those who have stepped inside this grand showplace. I mean, look at that line. A visit to the Ellen is like taking a trip back in time. The lobby alone features delicate jewel sconces, a sure sign of high living. Other eye-catching items include ornate crown molding, gilded plaster carvings, and a terrazzo floor currently hidden by some lovely 1980s carpet. People ask, they always say, can I bring this drink in the theater? And I always say, look at the carpet. Of course you can. Inside the theater, ruby red silk panels stretched to the towering ceiling, highlighted by decorative floral and seashell motifs sculpted by artisans 100 years ago. The Ellen was designed by renowned local architect Fred Wilson. And here you see, this is fabulous. We have all of his blueprints. So here's his signature, and May 16th, 1919. He was commissioned by the Sons of Nelson Story, and the theater was named for the family matriarch, Ellen Trent Story. That certainly is quite the present for mom. Any boys out there listening? Acoustic wizards of the day, prior to microphones being the norm, knew the secret to entertain large crowds so that all could enjoy every word. Arching over the Ellen stage is the proscenium. It's shaped like an immense megaphone, and it magically projects with perfect clarity music and voices to performers in the very back row. If you sit up in the balcony, the sound is actually better. It's louder and crisper. It's amazing how this place was built before microphones. From the top of this impressive arch, a gold curtain is gathered, and when lowered, flows to the floor like a waterfall. In theater speak, this is called the grand drape. And adding to the final touch, the sides are framed by magenta flanking curtains and golden tassels. Each square inch shows off our Sunday best every day of the week. High above it all is Ellen's majestic chandelier, an exquisite artwork itself, glowing with hundreds of crystal beads, a true reflection of a bygone era when playhouses were palaces and people congregated to be mesmerized by live theater. From its very first days, the Bozeman boasting a population of 6,000, the Ellen was part of a vaudeville circuit. So Butte was the biggest city west of the Mississippi for quite a while. The circuit went from Denver to Butte to Seattle to San Francisco. It says in the book 60,000. I don't know if anybody fact-checked me. I've heard 90,000, 60,000 for Butte. It was a very big city. Bozeman, there were 6,000 people. So the route went from Butte to Seattle. They would stop for one night here in Bozeman and all the vaudeville acts that came through here. There was a train track spur down by Ale Works, how there's that funky train track. So there used to be a spur that came right back behind the theater. And look at these beautiful 25-foot doors. So what they would do is the train car would pull up to these doors. They would open the doors. They would pull the scenery out of the train car, stand it up, and walk it into the theater so they never had to put anything together. Amazing technology. And at the very top of those doors, there's a pulley and a rope with a hook, and they would swing the hook out and get these steamer trunks and swing them in, and there's a trap door and then a slide, and they would slide the steamer trunks down to the dressing rooms. And all vaudeville houses are like this. Quite fascinating, actually. Without these doors, we would have not been able to get a full-size Surrey in here for Oklahoma last summer. So they still come in handy. We do use them now and then. Playbills from the day heralded a variety of stars appearing on the Ellen stage, including legendary ventriloquist Edgar Birkin and his sidekick Charlie McCarthy there. Backstage at the Ellen, and if you go through a side door and down some wooden stairs, it leads to the dressing rooms used by Bergen and McCarthy and hundreds of other vaudeville stars. Directly under the stage, these where all these dressing rooms are, each with the mirror and light bulbs. If you look under the counters, this is fascinating. The counters have been there for 100 years. You will find smudges of grease paint left decades ago by singers, jugglers, magicians, and acrobats. It was an old showbiz ritual for good luck. Now, we tell the story to everybody who performs here. And they all add their makeup, their pancake rouge, whatever, including a lipstick smudge, a splotch from Lily Tomlin. She was very excited to do that. Around a basement corner, there is a more history buff bounty, including a poster touting Mae Valentine, a star of a presentation of Bohemian Girl. Now, the reason I want you to see this is it says the new Ellen Theater. I love that. This was from October of 1920. In 1929, the Ellen kept up with the latest craze, installing newfangled sound equipment. The first talkie to grace Ellen's silver screen was Fred Waring's Pennsylvania's In Syncopation. If movies can talk, why not walls?
you could grow them there. Somewhere in the middle of this melodrama, there was a cruel twist in the plot. Many theaters, similar sisters across the country, faced the dilemma of moviegoers migrating to the local mall and the lure of the multiplex. The Ellen, being no exception, was now relegated to only showing films from an out-of-state theater chain. Us walls sadly watched attendance dwindle. The world of DVD rentals and video downloads turned one-time movie palaces into relics of a bygone era. This next picture, there was so much stuff just shoved in corners and stacked up, and everything that you see in the lobby you would have not seen. It was all paneled over, wallpapered over, acoustic ceiling tiles, and so all that just had to be pulled out. Anyway, it was sad what happened to the Ellen. Everyone likes a happy ending, and in 2005, Montana Theaterworks, a local nonprofit company, established the goal of saving this celebrated monument. With the help of Golden Angels, Elise Donahue, dear lady, Karen and Klein Gilhausen, MTW raised the needed funds to put a down payment on the building. But it was thanks to the Gilhausens and Elise that we were able to do that. Armed with a set of blueprints, yeah, we could clap, absolutely, absolutely. Blueprints and Martel Construction, and much help from George Mattson, local architect. April of 2008, there were work crews for this massive overhaul, all contributing long days and weeks. We were here, we set up a table in the lobby, and that was like our battle stations to get the work for the day. Martel guys were coming in on their days off to do this because it just kept going. We had so much to do. Anyway, weeks turned into months, but they finally got it done. And there was also a cachet of Fred Wilson's drawings for the restoration to match the way things looked. Had all these hand drawings that Fred Wilson had done, so we knew exactly how everything was supposed to look. Many of the fixtures you see in the theater today, they're either authentic, or they're replicas made from these drawings, or they're new creations from plaster molds of ones that still existed. Like those ones in that second lobby, there's like 7 or 8 of those lights. Two of them were missing, so a couple of them are replicas. Two rows of comfortably lavish red velvet seats were found buried in the basement and returned to the front of the balcony. The blueprints dictated story, friends, and family, these two rows. Some modern conveniences were also added. On the main floor, there's now a men's room. You might have been here when it was Carmike, a movie theater. That was where they sold the popcorn. But on the blueprints, it says Story Family Dining Room. Nice, yeah. The entire renovation took 8 months, and needless to say, everyone was very ready for the reopening. On December 4th, 2008, the Ellen Theater presented a live production of A Christmas Carol. Over 6,000 people attended that show, and Ellen was on her way to being once again a glorious showplace. Now, as this grand lady is about to celebrate her 100th year, I want to take you back to the facade the way it looked in 1919. That is a stained glass, elegant canopy. With Fred Wilson's blueprints and historical photographs, we are preparing to renovate the front of this building, a facelift for Ellen's birthday. If all goes according to plan, the project will start in June and we'll be ready to unveil it for our summer musical. So how does this jewel of a theater stay afloat in a town this size when all over the country so many similar venues have been razed, closed, or converted to retail space? I would like to quote Field of Dreams here. If you don't tear it down, they will come. In the last 5 years, over 200,000 people, 5 years, 200,000 people have been through these doors, a remarkable statistic highlighting an astounding first century. If her walls could talk, they would surely say that Ellen plans on being here for another 100 years, entertaining millions more along the way, and that makes for a lot of happy faces. Thank you.
You have just heard a celebration of Bozeman from the Heart, recorded at the historic Ellen Theater on February 11th, 2019. We thank the speakers for permission to broadcast their work. And in the order we heard them, Paula Beswick, June Safford, Steve Kirchhoff, Christy the Wordsmith Smith, Greg Keeler, Carolyn Panay, Valerie Hemingway, Keith McCafferty, Al Kesselheim, and John Luden. We especially thank the staff of the Ellen for their production assistance. The spoken word portion of this event can be heard archived at kgvm.org under the program heading Local Literati, where the earlier celebration of Bozeman from the Heart, which was recorded at the Country Bookshelf on January 30th, 2019, can also be heard. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, from the Heart. by Joy LeClaire.